Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. We have a great one today. And this time, I really, really mean it. And I'm serious. I have Lori Garrett, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who's been writing about infectious diseases for decades and decades. And she's just amazing. And Andy Slavitt is on with her. You know Andy. He's the former head of Medicare and Medicaid. And the whole podcast is basically on the vaccine. The vaccine, which many of us fully expect Trump to announce and release sometime in late October. And we discuss every aspect of that. And it's a pretty chilling discussion in a variety of ways. But I'm serious, you know, for a change, this is one you are really, really going to want to listen to. It's been quite a couple of weeks. Just before I taped this part of my podcast last week, we learned the stuff about Trump calling the men and women in the military, especially those wounded or captured, call them losers and suckers. And of course, this was no big surprise to most of us, because in 2015, Trump famously called John McCain a loser and said he was only a war hero because he got captured. I guess what Trump didn't understand is that less than a year into his 5.5 years in captivity at the Hanoi Hilton, he was offered early release by the North Vietnamese so they could get a propaganda victory. You see, McCain's father was an admiral and had command of Pacific forces. So if McCain, who was being tortured and starved, had taken early release before other prisoners who had been there longer, well, then it would have been a big propaganda victory for the North Vietnamese. And McCain knew that. He chose to stay. And he was there for another 4.5 years. That's a hero. That is a hero. You know, I have a slightly different take on Trump and the horrible things that he has said about our troops. And you know that he did say to John Kelly, when they were standing there at Kelly's son's grave at Arlington Cemetery, you know, he said, "What's in it for them?" Because if he hadn't said that, then Kelly, of course, would say something. His silence is deafening with this. So we know that he said that. Now, a lot of people think they understand why Donald Trump could not understand what was in it for them. You know, that he just can't grasp why anyone would ever do anything that didn't redound to their own personal benefit. And I'm sure that was part of it. That's the kind of transactional thinking that you'd expect from a malignant narcissist like him. But I believe it goes deeper than that, because what was also happening is that Donald Trump, surrounded by a forest of gravestones, actually feels threatened. Because anyone who is acknowledged as a hero could, in Trump's mind, steal from the adoration that he, as the most important man in the world, desperately needs to be basking in every second of his life. And sharing the spotlight with anyone, even dead people, makes him not just uncomfortable, but downright resentful. Let's go to the Woodward book and the fact that Trump knew how serious the coronavirus was all along and didn't act. But still, he says he's done a great job. And you hear him again. He said this week again, we saved millions of U.S. lives. Millions. And I just, let's look at what that means. First of all, just millions. That's plural. It could be anywhere from 2 million at a bare minimum, all the way up to just each and every 331 million of us. But that would have been a real disaster. But let's be optimistic about this. Let's say he just saved 2 million. Only 2 million dead Americans aren't dead because of his great work. So that means that instead of a mere 194,000 dead Americans out of 904,000 globally, we'd have 2,194,000 dead, which would be just over three times the current total fatalities worldwide. Now, Mr. President, I don't know what the guy who took your SATs got in his math, but if you subtract 194,000 from the 904,000 worldwide, you get 710,000 dead in the rest of the world, which is just shy of a third of the 2,194,000 American dead that we would have had if you, Mr. President, had just hadn't done anything. Now, I don't know exactly what the president counts as the actions he took. I suppose he could mean anything he did. Maybe he means that he wouldn't have done anything, that he just would have continued doing rallies and just done nothing. We're going to be talking about the vaccine that he most likely will release prematurely with Lori Garrett and Andy Slavitt, and it really is a great one. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Well, we've got a great one today for change. Two fabulous guests. If you're a fan of the podcast, you probably know Andy Slavitt. Here for the fourth time. Congratulations, Andy.
Thank you.
Andy was the head of Medicare and Medicaid during the last 2 years of the Obama administration. I've made the argument that he saved the ACA. He's the guy that got the exchange working after it crashed at the beginning there in October of 2013. So welcome back again.
Thank you, Al.
Okay, and I am absolutely thrilled to have Lori Garrett with us, one of the most influential writers on infectious diseases. In fact, she won the Pulitzer Prize in explanatory journalism. Lori, I don't think there's anyone more qualified to explain explanatory journalism than you. Could you just explain what explanatory journalism is?
Explanatory journalism is where all the guilty journalists dump the rest of us because they know that we deserve the prize, but they think very poorly of us.
Okay, good. I've written that down, so finally know what explanatory. I thought it was something like that, actually. So you just wrote an article, Lori, in Foreign Policy, right, that about the vaccines and about whether we can trust them or not if one comes out before the election. And can we trust a vaccine that comes out, say, what would be a good date, November 1st?
Well, that's their target date, November 1st. That is the date that the Trump administration instructed the CDC to instruct every single governor in the United States and territories to be ready for mass distribution and to, by October 1st, have sent CDC their master plan for how they will vaccinate their population for approval and then actually roll it out courtesy of a private contracting firm called McKesson on November 1st. But we saw a real blowback from political leaders and, of course, the public generally and the public health community saying, wait a second, how in the world can you imagine that you're going to have a safe, proven, effective vaccine in the next 50 plus days? That's just inconceivable. And 9 major vaccine makers jointly released a statement promising the world that they will not go along with being shoved out the door hastily, and that they will indeed do adequate safety and so on. And then AstraZeneca, which had the most promising vaccine, let it be known that they're stopping their trial temporarily because they've seen a side effect in one of the trial participants.
Let me stop and just say, ask you, how many vaccines are in the research pipeline?
Well, if you count the ones that are rather dubious from places like Russia, and you put them all in the pile, it's close to 200 are in the pipeline worldwide. There are basically 10 leading contenders that the United States government is looking at. Most of them are made in America, but there's also AstraZeneca made in the UK and a joint American-German product that is probably at the front of the line right now, jointly made by Pfizer and a German company. There are many, many, many products out there, all in various stages of testing, all the way from just in the laboratory to already in 30,000 trial subjects in phase 3 trials.
There is a political dimension to this, obviously. And Andy, I just want you to speak to that. I don't trust Donald Trump. Do you?
He has developed a track record here, which I think we should be paying attention to. I mean, first of all, the FDA scientists, the civil service scientists, are more than capable of running this EUA process, evaluating data, looking at adverse events if they occur. I think, Lori, the adverse event for this AstraZeneca trial was a swelling of the spine in one participant, which they're investigating. And these things happen. They come up. That's why you do these large-scale trials. And you want a trial to be accelerated, but you don't want it to be rushed. There's a long tradition at the FDA of letting the civil service scientists do their work. And while they can be technically overruled by the FDA commissioner, the secretary of HHS, or the president, it generally does not happen for a lot of good reasons. In this particular case, we've seen a president who has at least twice interfered in the FDA process. Once for a treatment called convalescent plasma, and once for a hydroxychloroquine example. So he set up a dubious record of pushing the FDA, and the FDA has caved on those occasions. So that's why Americans are nervous. That's why the blowback that Lori has talked about is occurring, because he's interfering with science. And everybody wants a vaccine, but nobody wants a vaccine that other people can't trust. Because a vaccine that comes out, no matter how good it is, if people don't take it, then we will prolong COVID-19 for a long, long time.
Would you take a vaccine, Lori, that the president introduces on November 1st?
No.
Okay. Okay, now, Most Americans probably don't know as much about this as you do. That's fair to say, right? So could you explain to Americans who don't know as much about vaccines and vaccine testing and protocols why you wouldn't take it?
Well, there's several things going on here. First, as Andy told you, there's been at least two other instances where the White House has pressured the FDA to reverse its position on convalescent therapy and on hydroxychloroquine, both of which overwhelmingly are shown not to work. It's not just that this administration has pushed the FDA to prior times to overrule the better judgment of its own scientists and of the NIH. It has also pushed to strip the ability of the FDA to analyze testing kits and determine whether or not they give valid results. That has now been destroyed. So it's been technically moved over to the office of the Secretary of HHS, Alex Azar. But what it in truth means is that now the market is getting flooded with test kits of all sorts, all various reliabilities. If you are a governor and you're trying to figure out which one to order for your state, it's a bloody mess now. And the FDA is no longer allowed to tell you this one's superior to that one, or this one fails to actually identify appropriate antibodies or appropriate antigens or appropriate RNA nucleic acid markers. Meanwhile, it's part of a larger package because we've now seen the White House order the CDC to reverse itself on schools, on testing, on a whole set of criteria that are essential for individuals and politicians to understand what to advise for their populations. And they ordered the EPA to reverse its own decision on the safety of a disinfectant for airplanes so that American Airlines could get back in the air. And they released one that is known to cause eye and face damage.
Let me ask Andy something, because we're talking about all these different agencies within these public health agencies, including the EPA but and the FDA and the CDC. And there appears to just be a lot of the kind of chaos that Lori is describing there. And this is a political thing. So as someone who is head of Medicare and Medicaid, what are you seeing there in terms of the politics of these agencies that we normally just feel like they're rock solid? You can really rely on the CDC. You can really rely on the FDA. What's going on here?
I think to try to make a distinction to the public, which is to say, you know, there's 17,000 career civil servants in the FDA. They are in every political administration. They are not driven by politics. They're driven by science. There are thousands and thousands of epidemiologists inside of CDC. And these are good people. I mean, these are some of the best people in the world at what they do. They're not always right, but their institution normally has processes that have all the kinds of checks and balances you'd like to see so that you make the best decisions possible. And they won't always get it right. We're always going to be mad at the FDA for either not going fast enough or being too sloppy. So they're always in that spot anyway. What I don't want to do is I don't want people to lose confidence in these institutions, because long term, we really, really need them. I mean, just close your eyes and imagine we were putting drugs on the market and we had no FDA or we had no epidemiologists in the CDC. So if we have problems with them and they made mistakes, and they clearly have, as Lori said, we need to reform them. But these are good long-term institutions, good long-term people. Now, your job when you come in to run an agency like this, like I did at CMS, normally your job, your most important job, is to protect the scientists from the politics. The most important thing you can do is let them do their technical work and protect them from the politics. And if you can't do that, you're in a troubling situation. And what we have today is a president who will tweet that the FDA is part of the deep state, and the FDA commissioner quite honestly folded like a tent the next day.
Stephen Hahn. And that was on the convalescent plasma therapy. Didn't he say that you were like 35% less fatalities if you took it?
he made a rookie mistake. It's a public health statistics 101 class mistake that, you know, a professor would gladly give you an F for, in which he looked at the differential between two data points and said, those two data points are 35% apart. That means there's a 35% benefit to the health. That was completely bogus. And he did mea culpa to his benefit. He did say, oops, I got that wrong. I misstated that. And then they turned around and they fired the entire public relations team in the hierarchy there at FDA. I want to say something to what Andy just said, because it's a very important point you're making, that we don't want people to distrust these agencies in the long run. In every single pandemic and epidemic role-playing exercise I was in over the last 30, 35 years, where we imagined, you know, disease X has shown up and here's what the fire department will do and here's what the public health community does, et cetera. None of us ever imagined a scenario ever in which we would have a president who lies, who is incompetent, and who uses his political power to force other agencies to basically misbehave, to go against their own mandate and their own charter. So we're in a situation now where very good people, the civil servants inside these institutions, if they're at CDC, they've been muzzled. They've been gagged. They can't talk to the public. They can't tell you what they know. If they're inside EPA, they've been told climate change is off the table and here's another 25 topics you're not allowed to ever discuss. And if they're at FDA, they're being told the president says this works. You will now say it works, period. End of story. This is not the way to protect the health and safety of the American people. This is the way to protect a political agenda of a president carried out by his cronies that he's appointed to run the various agencies.
I would even put it this way. The job of the FDA, most importantly, is to explain the claims that are valid on a given drug precisely. So if you were to come to the FDA and do what Commissioner Hahn did and say, hey, this drug, 35 out of 100 people lives will be saved, when in fact the number is like, well, 5, 6, 7%, and he grossly exaggerated it, you wouldn't just face a mea culpa. You might face civil penalties. You might face criminal penalties. Their job is to be the most precise possible in communicating this. And they know for a fact that the one stage they have to do it right is the first time they do it. And they did it in a presidential press conference. So Stephen Hahn, you know, maybe he made a mistake. If I were conducting an observational study on Stephen Hahn and Donald Trump, I would say my observation is he knowingly lied.
You know, Lori just said you get an F in college if you made a mistake like that, or I guess in graduate school maybe. But what was his background? How did he make this basic a mistake?
You know, he ran the National Cancer Institute, which is a part of FDA. It's not science that he has a problem with. What he has a problem with is understanding the big picture. And let me just explain what I mean by that specifically. Vaccine effectiveness and vaccine trust are equal. What I mean by that is you can have a vaccine that is only 30% effective, but if it's 100% trusted, you will get immunity on 30% of your population. Likewise, if you have a vaccine that is 100% effective, but it's only 30% trusted, you get the same outcome. So the FDA's role is not just to evaluate the efficacy of a vaccine. It's to be highly, highly trusted and to set up a process and say, this is our standard. And then under pressure from the president say, well, we're not going to follow that standard. That does so much damage, by the way, not just to this vaccine, but to all the vaccines that we count on in our modern society.
Well, and I would add that when Hahn made that statement and backed up the president, now let's keep in mind the timing on this. It was on the eve of the opening of the RNC, so that the president would be able to boast in his speeches to the RNC convention, hey, we've got a treatment. At that time, Hahn said, everything I am saying to you, quote, is based upon sound science. We totally, meaning the entire FDA, we totally support the EUA. That's the emergency use approval. And, quote, the timing was totally based on when we got the data, and these are the facts. And everything he said around those quotes turned out to be wrong.
I mean, I have to think that if you're head of the National Cancer Institute, you have some experience in evaluating studies. wouldn't you?
But you see, he claims in retrospect that it was his PR guys that gave him the wrong information, which, okay, if that's true, then for something this momentous, if you're trained in the sciences, why didn't you look at the real data yourself? Why would you trust a PR hack with no science training who came out of the Donald Trump school of lying? So everything about it to me smells to high heaven. The timing on it, everything, I just think this was all decided by the White House.
What does this portend to, as we head toward the election, of the strong possibility that the president will announce that there is a vaccine and that people are going to start getting it, I don't know, November 1st or
I think it depends on which of the main contenders that are actually in phase three trials already will be in a position to go to the already announced October 22nd FDA meeting that has been summoned experts to assess and decide which vaccine, if any, should get approval. And this would be an emergency use approval in which you're already acknowledging that all the necessary data won't actually be there. You're flying a little bit blind.
I think this is a matter of understanding Donald Trump. And so what I would say is one needle, one arm, one camera. Like man, woman, TV, whatever. So like a camera in a production facility watching vaccines being made, and then a vaccine, you know, ideally in the arm of some person of color, shot in the arm. And, you know, look, if it's not approved, he might just do that with someone who's taking the trial and might, you know, just even claim that they're, you know, that the FDA deep state is holding this up from getting into people. He is no doubt engineering something like that. And I think what Lori and I are saying is, you know, that's politics, but the fact that, but you know, to have willing accomplices running our major agencies is really problematic. And so I think people are going to need to scream out loudly. As Lori, I think, has done a really nice job of saying that the data will not be clear enough, but what they will very likely do is say, well, let's cherry pick. Let's take these 30,000 people, and if we only look at the people who are between 25 and 30 and who have X and Y level of exposure and these are people that have some risk, some higher risk, let's convince the FDA to say that the benefit outweighs the risk. And, you know, what I like to say is, you know what else the benefit outweighs the risk? Water. Water. So the FDA could approve water.
Okay, we're going to take a little break for this word from our sponsor.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, we're back. We're here with Lori Garrett and Andy Slavitt and talking about the coming vaccine, premature or not. Okay, we keep talking about the FDA. We keep talking about these agencies, these public health agencies in the United States. This is a global problem. we have...
Well, not from our perspective. I'm going to have to correct you, Al. It's the official opinion of the White House that there's nothing global about this at all, except if we want to cherry pick and buy up the supplies of products made outside the United States for the benefit of the American people. But no, we're refusing to participate in the global effort. There is a special 172 nations signed in on a joint effort to come up with a vaccine with agreement to make it affordable and available to the entire world, not just to the rich countries, and to not nationalize supplies, to not prioritize their own people over the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera. The United States said, nope. We're not in there. We're not in there partly because it's controlled by the WHO, and we've already said screw the WHO. But we're also not in there because, no, we're not going to make any such commitment at all. We're not going to agree to abide by any rules of the game other than our people first, MAGA, et cetera.
That suggests to me that Americans may very well just be guinea pigs for our preferred vaccine. How many countries did you say were part of that world group?
172 nations have signed on.
We're just alone then, right? So,
well, of the major manufacturers, yeah, we're hanging out in the wind. But I would say that two countries have already decided to go ahead and bypass phase three trials and poke their populations in the arms. That's China and Russia.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't trust China or Russia for some reason. Is that wrong? Anybody?
Well, anyway, how safe does a vaccine have to be before you take it?
If you have 1,000 people a day dying and you can reduce that by 50% a day and there would be a small risk to some of the people who took it, naturally, it would make sense to do that on as accelerated basis as possible.
Of course.
And, you know, again, I keep trying to draw the distinction between what our scientists are doing and what our politicians are doing, because scientists accelerating to learn as much as possible and generate the data to figure out that risk-reward trade-off, and FDA staff trying to get that done as quickly as possible. We should celebrate how quickly we're doing this. There's nothing magical about having this done by November 1st except for the election. And so if we can be much more certain what we're doing in another 2 weeks or month or 2 months or 3 months.
I think that people have a right to be concerned about the money and the profit and who's going to get what, knowing Trump the way we do. How much is profit and who's going to get selected, et cetera, a fear, you know, dealing with this administration and this president?
The reason you asked the question is because we've been trained that those are things to watch out for and to be concerned about and to question motivation. And so whatever the reason, whatever the motivation, I think it's too hard for the public to sort all that stuff out. And so instead, what I would suggest is we need an incredibly transparent process where the data can be seen and viewed and opined upon by independent scientists and legitimate scientists who put their name behind it. And, you know, you ask a question to Lori, would you take the vaccine on November 1st? You know, I think your answer is probably, I don't want to put words, but probably because I think she finds it impossible that data would be available by then and it feels force fit. But at some point in time, Americans will see that data and we will want to take the vaccine. We ought to be careful also not to react against what Trump is doing, which is clearly political, to the point where we create more vaccine hesitancy in this country than we really need. To take this one case we have right now at Oxford AstraZeneca, you know, there may be effects like this in one out of every 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 people. That's an acceptable risk if it's disclosed and if it's understood and if it's weighed against the benefits and if it's done in the light of day. So we shouldn't be afraid of understanding the data and having scientists tell us what their recommendations are. We just need to keep politics out of it. And that is just not going to happen, quite honestly, you know, in the next 60 days.
The way things are stacking up now with the combination of the anti-vaccine movement that's longstanding and has been out there for a while, but has had alignment with certain other political forces of late, including elements of the Trump administration. If that continues to grow, and all signs are that it is, it almost doesn't matter who is elected on November 3rd, President of the United States, or whatever date we finish the vote count. One side or the other could manipulate the situation. So, for example, even if Joe Biden is elected president, then I could imagine a scenario where sometime in next January or February, reasonable testing is completed. An FDA that is not under White House pressure and is operating on its old-fashioned good principles of science says this looks like a safe vaccine, this we recommend. Then the Trump-aligned anti-vaccine forces would go into high gear and start a massive disinformation campaign and do everything they can to undermine public faith and trust in that vaccine. And the reverse, I think, is also the case, not in quite as Machiavellian a sense, but certainly all surveys show Democrats right now are less trusting of a Trump administration approved vaccine than are Republicans. So here we go down the road, where yet another tool in the public health toolkit has been so deeply politicized that it will be undermined, utilized, or believed based on party affiliation.
This is what happens when you have a president who completely undermines any confidence in anything that anybody says in truth. This is a guy who will say anything that has created an atmosphere where no one trusts anything anymore, that he lies all the time, and he has divided people, and he's actually kind of destroyed any kind of trust in anything, and people are going to continue to die because of it, no matter who wins. That's pretty much what you're saying.
If Joe Biden wins and the vaccine reaches a point where it's recommended to be taken, and all the Trump supporters say, hey, wait a minute, I'm crying foul. There's already, as she says, aligned to the anti-vax movement. If you have large numbers of people, 50% of the people who say, I'm not taking the vaccine for one reason or another, then COVID-19 is with us for a lot longer because it will circulate a lot longer. If, on the other hand, Trump is reelected and the Democrats say, we're not going to take the vaccine, you have the same exact phenomenon. Imagine then, the next time you take your kids for the measles vaccine or the influenza vaccine, or there's another bug, and people say, well, you know what, last time around, this process was so politically polluted that I'm just going to take my chances. So this is like a global warming type of scenario where the president's kind of political marketing populism instincts get us in a generational level of destruction, potentially, of some of the things that we really count on as a modern society.
You know, let me put this in perspective. In 1947, America being triumphant in World War II and truly believing in the powers of good government, because good government had pulled America out of the Great Depression and won World War II. In 1947, a tourist came to New York City unknowingly carrying smallpox and went to every tourist site all across Manhattan and then died of smallpox, having infected several people. At that time, the health commissioner of New York City was a popular woman who had a regular radio show where she informed the New York people about health issues they should be concerned about. She went on her radio show and said, we are corralling every single dose of smallpox vaccine we can find in all of the United States. And we want all 6 million New Yorkers to get vaccinated, even if you got vaccinated before, because smallpox is here in the city and we need to stop it. And within less than a week, the majority of the population of New York City had put out their arms and stood in lines organized by the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts of America and gotten vaccinated. And they saved the day. And we did not have a smallpox outbreak in America. We could not achieve that today. It could literally be as dire as smallpox. And today's political environment, we would never get 6 million people to stick their arms out for a smallpox immunization scratch. There would be conspiracies. There would be claims that it's not really smallpox vaccine. It's X. It's Y. It's something that will sterilize you. It's something that will make you not believe in God anymore. I actually have heard that claim, that there's something in the vaccines that will make you stop believing in God, or it will turn you into a homosexual, or it will do this, or it will do that. And you go through the list. We are in a situation that is almost existential for the basic tenets and purposes of public health as a mission. And when you have a leadership in the country too timid and scared to stand up to the president and say, you lie, dude, shut up, get out of the way. Lives are at stake. The result is that every single institution, because they're all government employees, by definition, public health is government executed, they all just begin to muzzle, to self-censor. You have seen all over the country commissioners of health who tried to stand up to their mayor or their governor have been fired since COVID appeared. We've seen almost an anti-public health insurgency taking place. And I honestly believe that so much damage has been done that whoever is elected president of the United States next, and whatever the balance may end up being in the Senate and the House after all the votes are counted, we're still going to be in deep trouble trying to get some sense of collective, responsible belief in science and in the proof of evidence.
It's hard to fathom the damage that has been done to this country in the last 3.5 years, really, just in that regard, just in what we agree on in terms of what are facts. That has completely, completely gone away.
You pick a president, you pick a mistake, how long will we be paying for our adventures in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and right after 9/11? I think about all the things we'll be potentially paying for a long time. And that's more concerning than anything. And that's why I think people like us would all say, hey, if it takes another month to do it right, do it right. If it takes a year to build back our confidence in the FDA and CDC, we've got to figure out how to do that. To me, it puts a little bit of a mandate on Biden, if he were to win, to figure out how to govern this country in a way that breaks down some of these reflexive barriers where you just have a gut reflexive view based upon political party. And it's fine to do that for things that are politically philosophically different. It's not okay to be in a space, as Lori pointed out, where we have half the country that won't do what is important for 100% of the country.
And how predictable is it, if Biden wins, that there'll be this vested interest in his failure and America's failure from the 40% or whatever it is who just believe Donald Trump? And is Donald Trump going to lead a resistance?
This will put a lot of pressure on Biden's leadership. You know, in my conversations with the campaign over the last few weeks, I think they've been going through fits, as you would normally do when you have an opponent who lies. And most importantly, my advice to the campaign has been Biden ought to act the way he would if he were president. He ought to say people's lives are more important than this election, if that's what he believes, and I think it is. He ought to not come across as in any way as contributing to the distrust of the vaccine. He ought to not lose the election because of it, but he ought not to confuse the public any further, because that's what a good president would naturally be doing. It's a hard line to ride.
It is almost an impossible line to ride, because no matter what you do, there is very, very good reason to believe that Trump only cares about his reelection. Of course, right? There's a very, very good chance that he will announce a vaccine before November 3rd, and that there's a very good chance that we will have very good reason not to trust it and won't know. And what do you say? You have a conundrum politically that I think you've kind of framed Whereas if he starts bad-mouthing the vaccine, or he looks like he's rooting against people getting vaccinated and getting immunity to it.
And I think this is the setup that Trump is hoping for. I think the more controversial the decision to approve the vaccine, the better Trump thinks it is for himself. Because for most Americans, the details are hard to fathom. All the things we've been talking about are going to be lost. What the headline will be is, I got a vaccine done, even if it's over the objection of these pointy-headed scientists, and I had to run roughshod over them. That's what I'm here for. That's my brand. And for Biden to be baited into saying, well, but sorry, guys, process, 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 I don't think that's a winning political place to be. And it puts Biden in that spot.
But I think that there's an interesting couple of ironies here. One is, let us say that the October 22nd meeting ends up with FDA saying, yeah, we think this Pfizer vaccine is really cool. Go ahead, start poking people in the arm. And that the states comply and they start rolling out their various distribution sites. Do you actually believe that the hardcore MAGA followers will indeed line up with their sleeves rolled up? I don't, because they, first of all, overlap very heavily with the general anti-vaccine movement. And secondly, their own propaganda is already full of conspiracy theories about every one of these vaccine makers. So I think the only way Trump gets the photo op with 2,000 people stretched down the block with their MAGA hats on and American flags waiting to get vaccinated 24 hours before the national election. I think the only way he gets that photo op is if he first goes on live national television and lets them film him getting vaccinated and line up Ivanka and have her vaccinated live on national television. That is, by the way, not outrageous. That's precisely what Gerald Ford did in order to get people to go along with the swine flu vaccine in 1976.
But Gerald Ford actually was vaccinated with the swine flu vaccine. Do you think Trump would actually be inoculated with
Suspecting that he would take a placebo?
Well, he loves placebo, you see, because after hydroxychloroquine, he, for a moment there, he was going like, you know what's a great drug, I hear? It's placebo, because it's been in every trial. It's been used in every trial. And a lot of people say it really worked for them.
Well, because it's used as the comparator, so it must be good.
Yeah. I mean, it's in every trial, this drug, placebo. And I hear that people really think it works.
You know, there's another, not to take anything away from your point on placebo, but there's another point here that I think there's a racial dimension to this that we ought to be aware of. There is a very sad history, obviously, in this country of using racial minorities as experiments in vaccines. And, you know, there are a number of people who, for good reasons, are saying maybe people of color ought to be prioritized in getting this vaccine because they have higher fatality rates. But you can imagine a circumstance under which Trump says, hey, let's give it to the black and brown people, because I want to really show that that's the kind of guy I am. And he would not have established trust in the vaccine. And the damage that that could do to open up those wounds and turn a whole other set of people against vaccines is something I worry about. I don't know.
Nice wrinkle, Andy. I hope the president is listening to this. Jesus. Okay.
Well, actually,
it's getting worse as we go. Okay.
If you want to talk about cognitive dissonance, there was the very same day that we had the FDA indicating that it might go along with rushing the vaccine through with a target of November 1st distribution. That very same day, the National Academy of Sciences convened public hearings on its proposal for how to improve access to a vaccine when it is safe and available for indigenous peoples, native peoples, African Americans, Latinos, and so on. In other words, here we had on the one hand imagining a product that everybody's going to clamor for. How do you make sure that it's equitably available across all ethnic and racial groups in America? And over here we had, oh, we're not even going to worry whether it's really safe and so on. We're just going to shove it down the pipeline. So one scenario could play out, to a kind of a huge racial debate about who's at the front of the line. And the other scenario could play out to, hey, this is Tuskegee all over again.
Okay. Anything, can we get any uglier? Is there an uglier dimension to this than we haven't thought of yet?
We're going to get about 50 days uglier. I mean,
I'm sorry. I have a dark sense of humor, Lori. You should know that.
Yeah.
I don't think we've seen anything yet. I mean, I tried to imagine how ugly it can get, and I find myself only concluding that my imagination will look woefully inadequate relative to the stuff that actually is going to happen probably in the next 60 days.
You know, I know your imagination. I agree. Oh, man. Thanks. You know, part of the reason I do this podcast is to, you know, give a little sunshine to people, cheer them up. That's what we've done today, certainly.
I can tell you one thing, that if I had the ear of presidential candidate Joe Biden, would be on at the top of my list of recommendations. Right now, we have overwhelming evidence that the COVID disease is not a respiratory disease as it initially presented as pneumonia. Yes, people get pneumonia, but the real disease process is cardiovascular. And the cells that this virus nefariously destroys are crucial cells for the appropriate functioning of your heart and of the distribution properly of blood throughout your body. And organ after organ, all the way down to your kidneys, suffers because this essential circulatory function is impaired. We now know that explains why the highest risk association with going on to get severe disease if you're infected is a history of untreated hypertension. And you know, hypertension is the great silent disease. Nobody knows they have hypertension unless they routinely see a physician and get cuffed. They don't know it until they have a major cardiac event. It doesn't present with any obvious symptoms along the way. Well, as a result, if we were to re-envision how we conduct testing and how we tackle COVID to take a true public health intervention approach, everybody approaching a physician or a testing center would first get cuffed. And if they come up with high blood pressure, they would be diverted off to a line where they would be told, guess what? We can treat this, and it's cheap, and it's easy. And here's free medicine to start you off. Here's your first workup appointment with a cardiologist, because this is really high risk. And next, we're going to send you to this line where we give you a quick pinprick, and we do a quick blood test. And if you have high blood glucose, you're at risk for diabetes. So we're going to send you over to this line where you're going to be sent off for free treatment to work you up for diabetes, and you're going to get nutrition education and so on. Now that you've had that, now you can have your COVID test. If we can begin to couple the underlying disease associations and tackle the cheap, low-hanging fruit of public health that are the major causes of death and that are why we see a racial distribution in death and mortality associated with lack of appropriate access to healthcare plus dietary issues. If we can get to the bottom of that, we can not only be tackling COVID, but we could dramatically reduce the burden of death from these two categories of illness.
I want to live in that country.
This is something that you, Andy, have very assiduously worked toward. This is almost your life's work, is getting us to universal health care. That's what you do now. That's your main focus of your work. And that's what the Affordable Care Act was about, was getting more people doctors, getting more people. Medicaid expansion has meant that so many more people go to a doctor and get cuffed and get blood tests. That's something beneath all of this, this subject.
Al, let me just throw one thing right directly to Andy, because you know the political shenanigans behind a lot of this much better than anybody else I know. One of the things that we're seeing now associated with this push for testing, and this would be a place where I blame the Democrats for not thinking through clearly what they were saying when they were shouting testing, 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 testing for what, how, where, and when, is that city after city, including my town here, New York City, have started to devalue their public health departments, devalue the necessity to have guided, epidemiologically thought out testing that really gives you reasonable information. And by the way, might couple it with such things as I had suggested about hypertension and diabetes. And instead, they're privatizing everything. They throw it all to the hospital sector. They throw it all to organized medicine. Well, organized medicine is not about population health. Organized medicine is about individuals' health. And most of the hospitals that it's getting thrown to are, you know, operate on pretty high profit margins. And they're turning testing into a function that's utterly divorced from public health, completely divorced. It's an individualistic function in which you as an individual feel safer because you underwent a test, though you don't even know the difference between an antigen test, an antibody test, a nucleic acid test, and what the information means. And I actually, you know, I've chronicled hundreds of epidemics and outbreaks throughout history around the world. I've personally been in more than 30 epidemics, and I have consistently seen this tension emerge where organized medicine and medical corporations come up against public health and squash public health. You know, if there's one point where the Democrats could make themselves very, very, very different on COVID and other issues from the Republicans, it would be to once again show respect, show just decent respect for the institution of public health and how that is different from individual medical care and clinical medicine.
Yeah, she's exactly right. We spend about, call it $10,000 on people's health care, and we spend something like $50 to $60 across the country on public health. That is so out of whack and so out of balance that we're going to get sicker and sicker. And of course, we're doing this in a country that increasingly cares more about themselves than about others. And so this escalates the importance here. And look, the thing is, we really need both public health and primary care. The one thing we know is that people who have a regular source of primary care for a sustaining period, like 3, 4, 5 years, see dramatic improvements in their health and reductions in the cost of their health care. People who don't are in worse situations. So what I love about what Lori's saying is we have a teachable moment right now. What if we took advantage of that teachable moment to say, okay, we're going to get you a safe vaccine, and in the process, we're going to connect you to the healthcare system in ways that are going to keep you healthy, that it's going to be much, much lower cost, and we're going to move this country, we're going to turn this negative into something that's a positive. Our country was once capable of doing stuff like that. Places around the world, other countries, are very capable of doing stuff like that. The test is whether or not we still are.
Well, guys, what you're asking for, you know, my first instinct is, well, that's not going to happen, but it could, but only if we have a real change in this election, obviously. Thank you, both of you. This has been a terrific discussion, and I'm going to, when we edit it, take myself out as much as possible.
Thank you, Al.
Thanks, Al. Nice talking to you. Nice talking to you, Lori.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.